and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in down. I'm Melvin McKay, President of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, ILWU Local 10, and chair for today's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet, commonwealthclub.org, or download the clubs on your iPhones and Android apps for the programs and scheduled information and podcasts for the past programs. And now, on to today's program. This year marks the 80th anniversary of the 1934 Pacific Coast Maritime Strike to protest the miserable hiring practices and poor working conditions. The strike up and down the entire West Coast from Bellingham to San Diego. And it's also the 80th anniversary of Bloody Thursday on July 5, 1934, when clashes between San Francisco police picketers result in two strike supporters being killed and hundreds wounded. In that aftermath of Bloody Thursday, 127,000 workers representing 160 unions walked off their jobs in protest. During that landmark general strike, they shut down San Francisco for 3 days before arbitrators granted most of the longshoremen's demands. These events helped bring about the national legislation in the 1935 that established collective bargaining and set up the National Labor Relations Board. The Commonwealth will soon occupy the building that was the Longshoremen's Union Hall at the time of the 1934 strike. This fall, San Francisco spent up to $160 million on a new cruise ship terminal named after veteran labor leader James Herman. A one-time port commissioner and head of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, opened for business. This pertains a new era for the economic activities and jobs on the waterfront throughout the city. What is the legacy of 1934, and what are the lasting contributions and legacy of union leaders such as Harry Bridges? Today, we're pleased to take a special look at labor history. Dr. Harvey Swartz is a historian for the ILWU, creator of the ILWU Oral History and Collection. He earned his PhD at the University of California, Davis, where he studied with the eminentious labor historian David Brody. Swartz's writing included March Inland, Origins of the ILWU Warehouse Division, the 1934-38, and the Solidarity Stories, and the Oral History of the ILWU. Dr. Robert Cheney, Professor Emeritus of the History of San Francisco State University. His PhD is in history from the Columbia University in 1972. His major interests research are the United States political history, the history of California in the West, of labor and urban history. He is the author or co-founder of the numerous books as well about the 30 essays in journals and anthropologies. He plans to complete his biography of the late legendary labor hit leader Harry Bridges in the near future. John Castano is a third generation member of ILWU and 28 year member of Local 10. His grandfather worked in ILWU Local 6 from 1945 to 1960. His father worked for Local 10 from 1963 to 1986. During his tenure at Local 10, he served several terms as Secretary of Treasury, Executive Board Member, Caucus and Convention Delegate, Board of Trustees Members, formerly served as Chairman of the ILWU Coast Safety Committee, and during which time he's appointed to serve two terms in the Maritime Advisory Committee for OSHA. Specialist, as a position he currently serves as ILWU Coast Benefit Specialist, a position he's held since 2007. Carl Nolte, a fourth-generation San Franciscan, he's been with the San Francisco Chronicle since 1961. He is currently a general assignment reporter and writes a column called Native Son of Sundays. He's covered San Francisco in the West, and he's been an editor for War Correspondence and extremely covered the labor and the waterfront. Carl is a recipient of the Maritime Heritage Award from San Francisco Maritime National Park Association, President Medal from the California Maritime Academy, and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of Professional Journalism. Our moderator today is Tim Poulsen. Executive Director of the San Francisco Labor Council since 2004. The Labor Council is in the center of labor activities in San Francisco and is comprised of 150 local unions representing 100,000 working men and women in San Francisco. Tim has over two decades of extensive experience in labor movement. Tim holds a bachelor's degree in economics and political science and serves on many committees and boards, including recently elected AFL-CIO President Richard Trunka's Advisory Committee on San Francisco Federation and Central Labor Councils. Please welcome Tim Paulson.
So thank you, President McKay, and thank you for the Commonwealth Club for hosting this very important historical topic today. And I think I'm just going to dive right in and get into our thoughts from our panelists. And I'm going to start off with Dr. Schwartz, and we should just move our way right down the line. I'm going to ask just to give an overview on what you think the legacy and the importances of the 1934 strike and really what it means for San Francisco. Dr. Schwartz, if you could start.
Sure. It's an honor to speak to the Commonwealth Club, and I appreciate being invited. Professor Cherney and I decided to split some of the issues on 1934. Hope I don't step on his toes, so I'll try to go forward. First of all, let's take a look at the pre-strike conditions. What were the problems on the waterfront? Well, there was a big strike in 1919 that had been lost, and control of the waterfront was really in the hands of the steamship owners, but also an organization which was a company-controlled group. It was called the Blue Book by nickname because of the color of its book. It functioned really as a way to control the workers and to make sure that they didn't have real collective bargaining, real worker-controlled unionism. On the waterfront, by the mid-20s, early 20s for that matter, by 1934, people shaped up on the waterfront right by the ferry building to get jobs. And there you sometimes had to pay for your job. That is to say, you had to pay a kickback. It could be booze, it could be money, and various things. There were many, many things that were difficult and wrong on the front. The loads were excessively heavy. That is, they'd be in slings. This is the same time period when you don't have containerization yet. Everything's hand-done work. Loads in slings could be extremely heavy. The equipment could be rotten. It could be unsafe. There was something called the speed-up, which meant you made people work really, really fast to increase productivity. They even had ethnic gangs that were forced by the bosses to compete with one another for speed. So the result, as Professor Cherney has sometimes pointed out, with the result was there were a very high number of accidents on the waterfront. There were certain degrading issues that went on. Sometimes a worker had to paint the house of a boss on the weekend. Sometimes you had to put money into a lottery for which there were no prizes. And this one, I think, is a bit of a zinger, but there's a longshoreman named Henry Gaetan from Los Angeles, in the port down there, who told me in the 1980s, he said, "This is if you're looking for a job, if you had a nice-looking sister and liquor and a wife that would put out, you had a job on the waterfront. I seen this here on these docks." And that's a direct quote. So you see, conditions were really terrible. As Professor Cherney will note, one of the main demands of the strike was for a better hiring system. There were lots of famous aspects of the strike. We can't go into all of them, but the employers tried to force open the port, and that's literally force open the port, utilizing volunteers from companies who had tear gas to demonstrate, so they gassed the workers. So they could show the police force that this stuff really works now. It's tear gas and things like that. There were beatings, there were shootings, all kinds of things went on. It looked like a war zone on the waterfront. It culminated, I think, as Melvin noted briefly, in Bloody Thursday, July 5th, when a couple of guys were killed, several sent to the hospital in San Francisco in a big confrontation. Then there you had a big funeral parade at Market Street on July 9, culminated finally in the general strike, which is a protest strike between the 16th and the 19th of July. When the employers, again, faced a strike in 1936, they did not try to use violence because they'd learned the hard way it didn't work the first time. There are additional famous things about that situation in 1934. The rise of Harry Bridges as a leader is one of them. He insisted on a coastwide contract that would keep different ports from working on each other when there were strikes. He insisted black workers come into the union. This is way before there's a civil rights movement. It's 20, 25 years before that. He went to the black churches in San Francisco and said, this time, guys, the black community's going to get a shot. They had been discriminated against in a prior union situation before 1919. Well, the union retained this kind of humane perspective. It also inspired other people to organize. For example, the carpenters up in Santa Rosa put in their minutes, if the longshoremen could do it, this is about 1937, if the longshoremen could do it, we can do it. All kinds of organizations sprung up. The union tried to help a lot of them. They had their own so-called march inland into warehousing and distribution in San Francisco, organizing 8,000 workers. It wasn't entirely out of a do-good perspective, but to some degree it was. There was also strategic reasons for it. The union organized at least 26,000 Japanese and Filipino workers on the Hawaiian Islands in the mid-40s. It goes on. The union stretched, in other words, its hand out to other organizations. They fought for civil liberties over the years. They fought against various wars like Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. They joined the civil rights movement or supported it greatly in the 1960s, supported Cesar Chavez. The legacy is extremely long. It might be emphasized that in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the waterfront was a place where a lot of San Franciscans worked. Many, many more people were involved in the front, either on the waterfront or in spin-off jobs of one sort or another. And that's kind of declined with the mechanization, which really goes by the name containerization, big containers on the ships now. The workforce on the waterfront declined, it is true. But still in all, it seems to me that this long legacy of the ILWU, which is a remarkable organization, has really survived ever since that time. I think that's going to have to do it for me.
Thank you, Dr. Schwartz. I think that was the most succinct four-minute, five-decade history of a union from conditions to what was moving on. So thank you. Professor, if you could also answer the question, talk about the legacy and the importance of 1934.
Thanks, Tim. I'm going to focus especially on some of the immediate outcomes of the 1934 strike for those who were working on the waterfront at that time, and then look at a somewhat bigger picture, the way in which that strike and other events in 1934 affected national policy. But I want to begin with the longshoremen, the men who were on strike in 1934. Out of that strike, they built a strong union, a very strong union, a strong organization along the entire coast from Bellingham to San Diego, with a very good system of communication among those locals. The strike was settled through arbitration. Initially, there had been a lot of opposition to arbitration, but in the end, there was a vote of all of the striking longshoremen, and they agreed to accept arbitration. And arbitration turned out to be a very good thing. It gave them many of the things they wanted, almost everything. It gave them a coastwise contract so that there were the same wages, hours, and working conditions in every port. As a result, ports could not compete against each other by reducing working conditions. They got wages of 95 cents an hour, a 10 cent an hour increase. And they got a six-hour day, a two-hour decrease from what they had had, and 30-hour week, which sounds unusual to many of us today, but it's something that stayed in that contract ever since then. The way it worked out is that longshoremen typically work eight-hour days but get 2 hours of time and a half overtime. They got a union dispatcher, which was an absolutely crucial element in their success. Harvey described the shape-up, the way in which men went in San Francisco, they went to the ferry building at 7 a.m. and tried to get a job for the day. that strike changed that process of hiring forever, because arbitration gave them a dispatcher elected by union members. This gave the union significant power. It changed the whole hiring process. One of the changes that resulted from this was the concept of low man out. Control of dispatching permitted the union to implement a system that was designed to equalize pay among all union members. So union members, who became known as A-men, had first priority in being dispatched for jobs. And jobs were assigned according to the principle of low man out, which meant that the longshoreman on the A list who had worked the fewest hours was assigned first. And this was a way of spreading the work equally among all the members of the union so that no one would be favored with more work by a generous foreman or a foreman who felt that that there'd been some kind of a payoff. Controlling the dispatcher also meant that there would be no discrimination in hiring. Because they control dispatching and they applied the rule of low man out, there would be no discrimination on the basis of race or politics or anything else. And in the San Francisco local, they voted to prohibit segregated work gangs in the mid-1930s. Controlling the dispatcher gave them increased control over work conditions. Harvey mentioned some of the problems with safety on the waterfront, where there were large sling loads. The slings brought the goods out of the ship, out of the hold, or lowered the goods into the hold. And there were men working right under that sling. So those sling loads had to be built carefully, and the bigger they were, the more dangerous they were. Gang size was another safety issue. Were there enough men working in the hold? Were there enough men working on the pier to handle those loads? The dispatch system gave the union a great increase in control over those key working conditions. Because if a gang was dispatched to a job where they felt the working conditions were unsafe, they'd refuse to work. And they'd be sent back to the hiring hall, and the dispatcher would send another gang, and that gang would refuse to work under unsafe conditions. And sooner or later, the foreman and the companies got the message that they weren't going to get any work done under unsafe conditions. So controlling the dispatcher gave the union a significant degree of control over sling load size and gang size. And they communicated among all the locals on the coast as to what they were doing, so that they were all aiming at the same working conditions, the same sling loads, the same gang sizes, all up and down the coast. And eventually, the companies got the message and wrote these into the contract so that sling load sizes and gang sizes were actually written into the contract. One of the things that came out of that strike as well was a commitment to arbitration. The union had been reluctant to accept arbitration, but eventually decided it was a good thing. The 1940 contract created a process for the immediate arbitration of disputes over working conditions. So the contract recognized the right of men to stop work if they felt that that it was a dangerous job, if it endangered their health or safety. But in that circumstance, a port arbitrator was immediately sent to the site, made a decision on the spot, and the decision was binding on both the workers and the employers. And the arbitrators were chosen in equal numbers from the companies and the union. I've been to conferences of historians who study longshoremen in different parts of the world, and I raised the question as to whether anything like this exists anywhere else, and no one said it did. So I'm the best of my knowledge, this system of arbitration is unique in the world as a way of preventing unsafe working conditions and also guaranteeing the right of workers to raise those issues, but also to prevent work stoppages that the arbitrator decided were not worthwhile. There were improvements in wages. By 1949, the median income of San Francisco Bay longshoremen was just over $3,000, which doesn't sound like much today, but it went a lot further in 1949.
Yeah.
Half of the San Francisco longshoremen earned more than $3,000, if that was the median, and only a quarter of New York longshoremen earned that much. So wages on the West Coast were significantly better than in the biggest East Coast port. All in all, between 1934 and 1960, a longshoreman's earnings for an eight-hour day increased by 62% in constant dollars. So that was another outcome. Just one more thing, and then I'll pass on the microphone. There were a lot of strikes in 1934. The strike here was not the only one. There were strikes all over the country. And in some part, this was a reflection of the failure of a law that had been passed in 1933, the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was designed to recognize the right of workers to join unions and encourage unions and companies to sit down together and agree on working conditions. But as it turned out, the companies weren't particularly interested in sitting down with workers, and the result was a strike wave all across the country in 1934, which led Senator Robert Wagner of New York to propose legislation in 1935, which became the National Labor Relations Act. They turned from a policy encouraging cooperation through collective bargaining to a policy of regulating labor relations, establishing the rights of working people in collective bargaining. And that law is still the basic law governing labor relations today, although it's been amended a number of times.
Now, thank you, Professor. And as I see some of the questions coming in and I hear some of the things happening, I'm going to remind myself next time to become a part of the panel so I can answer some of these questions instead of moderating right now, because it is true, the National Labor Relations Act in the United States is totally broken right now, and the workers' right to participate against the boss has really been diminished by regulations and court rulings. So I'm going to go next to our journalist, Carl Nolte, and we'll finish up this first question with an ILWU member. So, Mr. Nolte, perspective on 34 and the importance.
Well, I think the first thing that you want to consider is how was the strike perceived by the public in 1934? It sounds like, from what you said, it was a famous victory and all kinds of wonderful things happened. And one would think that the public would be eager to accept such a resolution. But in 1934, you consider what the media is now. Of course, we all, like myself, believe there are two sides to every story, and that must be true now, today, right? But just tune in Fox News or Rush Limbaugh to see if that's the case, or Rachel Maddow or anybody else. But in 1934, the media consisted of social media had not come into existence. Television was not invented. Radio news was just an adjunct to entertainment and shows on the radio. So that left the print newspapers. There were four in San Francisco: the Chronicle, the Examiner, the Call Bulletin, the San Francisco News, and two in Oakland: the Tribune and the Post-Inquirer. The two of the San Francisco newspapers, the Examiner and the Call Bulletin, were owned by the Hearst Corporation, which also owned the Post-Inquirer in Oakland. The other Oakland paper was owned by the Nolan family, a stalwart of the Republican Party. So these newspapers represented a point of view, and their point of view was, they were not reluctant to share it with everyone, their point of view was they were in favor of the establishment, and the establishment was about 176% against the 1934 strike in every way, until, of course, Bloody Thursday happened, and when it became clear that the situation had escalated out of control and the police had killed two people and wounded several others by indiscriminate use of the cops. So the opinion in the papers even swung around toward the strikers, especially after the big funeral march up Market Street and everything else. If you read the accounts of it, you could see that the coverage in the newspapers had totally shifted from being absolutely hostile to the strikers to be at least more sympathetic, especially the stories I've written, the Chronicle particularly, of the funeral procession up Market Street for the two dead people killed in Bloody Thursday. But this was also reciprocated by the strikers who regarded the reporters sent out to cover the strike as agents of the cops and the scabs. And one of the photographers for the San Francisco News was beaten so badly by the strikers he ended up in the hospital. He was Joe Rosenthal. You may remember him from the famous picture he took on Iwo Jima after, of course, he recovered. He once said that what he saw in World War II did not compare to the violence he saw on the San Francisco waterfront in 1934. Is that right, Harvey? Yeah. So later it swung around, but the Hearst papers were particularly opposed to this and then to the strike because for various reasons. One reason was they had their own union issues themselves because the members of the editorial staff of the papers had received several pay cuts. They had lousy pay to begin with, and it became even lousier. And in the 30s, they tried to organize a newspaper guild. The reaction of that by the Hearst papers in San Francisco was to fire people who tried to organize a union or demote them from drama critic to some guy covering checking hotel registers or something like that. I was a member of the guild. I am a member of the guild for more than 50 years, and we have a thing on our wall called Guild Martyrs. We still have them. But later, when the opinion swung around, the Hearst papers still insisted that the leader of the strike, Harry Bridges, was a communist agent and tried to get him deported. And this went on for how long did that go on? 20 years? 10 years?
Till at least 1955.
Yeah, that, yeah. So there's an example of this, of a statement from the mayor at the time, Angelo J. Rossi, 1939. A matter of fact, just about the 5 years after the strike. He told the Chamber of Commerce yesterday afternoon that the problem of an open port is not a local one, but one for the state and the nation. San Francisco and the governor of the United States, the mayor of the county of San Francisco declared, will have to wipe out irresponsible, un-American, alien, radical leadership and have to do it by force of public opinion or the future of the nation is gravely periled. Striking for the third time at communist leadership of the San Francisco waterfront unions, the mayor Rossi, again named Harry Bridges and Harry Schmidt, as symbols of a leadership which he said is opposed to in dealing with the waterfront strikes. We are not dealing with the ordinary strike, he declared. We are dealing with a strike born of communist and alien dictation. They work deviously, they thrive on lies, and they twist the truth. So that was the view of the San Francisco establishment of the 1934 strike and its leaders. So when you hear about what they say now, you see that it was perceived somewhat differently in 1934 and later, and that was the message that was the people of San Francisco saw as filtered through the media at the time.
Great, thank you. John, ILWU member, your perspective.
So as the least senior person up here, I guess you can tell I belong to a union because the more senior gentleman went before me, so I'll try to fill in the gaps. So 80 years later, I am three generations removed from the 34 strike. What impact, you know, what does this all mean today? I think there's some things that are more readily visible than others. What was one in the 34 strike, things like recognition of the ILA as the sole bargaining unit for the longshoremen, which is now the International Longshore Warehouse Union. Before then, there were other unions that were trying to represent the longshore workers, and it was a race to the bottom. Everyone was trying to cut a better contract for lower wages so they could have their workforce represented. Harvey mentioned about the union-run hiring hall, where the dispatcher, the person that signs work, is elected each year through a democratic rank-and-file process. And if that person somehow doesn't do the right thing, doesn't dispatch work correctly, he can be voted out of office, and a person can be voted in to replace him or her. And then, of course, we have a coastwise contract. Significance of that is we have one contract with the same work rules, the same wages, the same hours, shifts, everything, whether you work in Bellingham, Washington, clear down to San Diego, California, and everywhere in between. and this differs very much from our counterparts in the East and Gulf ports. But I think there's several things that are not very readily seen that are also very pervasive today. It was mentioned earlier that African Americans were integrated into our workforce, and that's very evident today. My local 10, is over 65% African American. Now, when I started 28 years ago, and I'll mention George Romero sitting back there, Bobby Christensen, Tony Machado, these guys I looked up to. I was 19 when I started on the waterfront, and then you guys remember when you were 19, we all thought we knew everything. And I got an education on the waterfront that I couldn't get in any classroom. You know, I was taught the value, my father taught me the value of hard work, but I was taught things about politics that you could never learn in a classroom, you know, things that were going on in other countries, like apartheid was a really big deal when I started on the waterfront. I learned the importance of looking out for each other, you know, moral lessons, the importance of sharing with one another. And when you talk about these things today, it just seems so counter-corporate America. It's you know, it's strange. When I talk to my kids, they're so used to, Dad, you know, we got to do better, we got to do this, we got to do that. But there was a time in this country where we all really kind of looked out for each other. And I'm proud to say I belong to an organization that still tries to do that. And that was instilled in me in a very young age. Now, my grandfather started in 1945, and he was part of the March Inland. He came here from Portugal, didn't speak any English. And believe it or not, there were times and places in this country where if you were a non-English speaker, you were not welcome to work in a lot of places. But the ILWU welcomed my grandfather. He worked at Albert's Grain Mill in Oakland, which is now TraPac Terminal, for those of you who know the Port of Oakland. My father emigrated here in 1963 as a non-English speaker. He was welcomed into ILWU Local 10. And for many years, he worked in a break bulk gang. He worked in Gang 43. And this is before the advent of containerization. Now, when containers came around, obviously this is, you know, changed the waterfront and allowed the work move to Oakland. But as far as the San Francisco landscape went, I'm pretty much living proof of someone who reaps the benefits of many of the battles that were fought for and won in the 1934 strike. And having a forum like this, I think, is very important to keep those memories alive, either talking directly or indirectly with people who were there, or people who have studied that time period, because it is a part of San Francisco, it is a part of the Bay Area, the fabric that we are, and it's something that shouldn't be forgotten. And I hope that this forum in some way provides an opportunity for us to not only re-educate ourselves, but to pass this along to the next generation. Thank you.
Thank you, John. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our topic is the 80th anniversary of the 1934 San Francisco labor strike and Bloody Thursday and their legacy going forward. Our panelists are Dr. Harvey Schwartz, historian of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, ILWU, Dr. Robert Cherney, the history professor emeritus at San Francisco State University, John Castano, a member of ILWU Local 10 and the Coast Benefits Specialist, and Carl Nolte, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm Tim Paulson, Executive Director of the San Francisco Labor Council and the program moderator. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. So what I'd like to do, because there's enough questions here to just read them, will probably take another half hour. I want to sort of tee these up and find out which way we can go. One question here from the audience says, was arbitration opposed by both the PMA and the ILWU, and how did the parties ultimately agree to it? Do you guys have an insight on how that happened? I know that you had referenced that it went to arbitration in 34.
There was no PMA in 1934. Right. There was a Waterfront Employers Union. And it was a coalition of various shipping companies, steamship companies, stevedoring companies, and so forth. The companies really resisted arbitration, just as many of the union leaders resisted arbitration, because arbitration meant that they were losing control. And both felt that they, if they could hold out long enough, they could control the outcome. But eventually, the business community of San Francisco put such pressure on the companies that they agreed. There was supposedly a meeting held down in San Mateo County where the shipping companies were told that if they didn't agree to arbitration, all the newspapers were going to publish that they had agreed and it would be up to them to deny it. As I said earlier, the longshore workers voted to accept arbitration. It was arbitration by a presidentially appointed panel, as I said earlier, it gave the strikers almost everything they'd asked for.
Great, thank you. One question, and maybe Dr. Schwartz or maybe John can mention it. I know that when I was asked to moderate this program, and also it was acknowledged that the Commonwealth Club was buying, it was going to be developing a building on the waterfront that has a history with the ILWU and the Longshore Workers Union. I asked if they have talked to anybody about that history, and they said yes. They immediately called the ILWU. So I don't know if John or Harvey want to have a comment on the significance of that building and what the Commonwealth Club is going to be doing.
Well, the Commonwealth Club is purchasing the old building, which is located on the waterfront at Mission Stewart, which was headquarters in 1934 of the organization. At that time, its name was the International Longshoremen's Association, the ILA. So the old ILA headquarters during the big strike has been purchased. It's not been used for a long, long time. The inside of it is very different. The Commonwealth Club has agreed to make the facade that faces Stewart Street look like it did in the 1930s. They've also agreed to put a plaque outside, and they've actually asked us to draft it. They're also going to have some display material on the inside in the lobby area. So all kinds of people who visit Commonwealth Club happenings will pass by informational material on the legacy of labor and the ILWU in San Francisco. There's a side that faces the other direction, that faces the Embarcadero, which is not the side that you see in the photos of 1934, and that side has to be changed. The facade has to be changed because the club needs room to hold its meetings. It's going to have a couple of halls, one 300 for 300 people, one for 150. It's going to be quite something. So it seems to me that this is about the best possible resolution of the long-term life of this building that's possible. There will be recognition of its historical legacy there. So that's part of what's happening now. Bob?
If I can just follow up on that too. The it wasn't just an ILA office building. If we're looking at the July 5th, 1934, and the events that happened that day, and we also have to recall that there was a battle that took place between maritime workers and the police. And there were people that were clubbed and hit with bricks, sticks, and even shot. And the wounded maritime workers were taken to this hall, this very same building that we're talking about, were treated there. And there were two maritime workers that were killed, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. Both of these gentlemen had their bodies brought to this building, and they laid there in state until July 9th, the day of the funeral, which Dr. Schwartz mentioned earlier. So there is a very important significance historically beyond the fact that it was just an ILA building.
Great, thanks. I'm trying to get a lot of these questions are labor-oriented, not quite exactly directed about ILWU and the history, but let me try to move some of these. So from the audience, the struggle against the boss's control of hiring on the waterfront was a lightning rod, as was mentioned, for mobilizing the 34 strike. Now in 2014, the bosses want to now have more control of hiring, and there seems to be less ability for the workers to work out of seniority in hiring halls and stuff like that. Are there some comments that the panel would like to mention about some of those trends?
I can tell you that The waterfront work is rather unique in that it's not your typical 9-to-5 office job. You just show up, go to work Monday through Friday. When the ships are in, we go to work, and when there's no ships in, there's not much work. And our workforce is split between a group that is steadily employed, so they go to the same terminals every day. They work the same shifts every day, usually on a Monday through Friday basis. And then we have workers who pick up work on a daily basis from the hiring hall, and our hiring hall is on 400 North Point Street. And each day they pick up a job assignment for a different ship, different terminal, different pier, different port. And it all depends on how and when the work is coming into the ports. There's always a struggle between labor and the employers as to controlling how many of the workers can work steadily, how much work opportunities should be afforded to those through the hiring hall. There's always a lot of pressure on bending work rules, changing work rules, extending the work day, and this is just a natural progression of labor relations. But the ILWU has been very vigilant in not trying to retain as many of the conditions that we have today. So I hope that answers that question, Tim.
Yeah. Sure. Dr. Schwartz, please.
Sorry, Harvey. You know, all workers need a hiring hall. You just have to go by Home Depot, and you can see the shape up right there at this right now in this era. Everybody should have a hiring hall based on the model of the ILWU one. Labor laws were changed in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Amendment to the National Labor Relations Act, passed in 1935, making it much more difficult for organization to go forward, making it much more difficult to have the kind of hiring hall that longshoremen had. The longshoremen have made adjustments to sort of get around that law, but the law has really changed since 1935. It's much more difficult for workers now to get a hiring hall like these folks built in 34, but we certainly need it for workers today, no question.
So let me ask another question. So we've been talking about, you know, the legacy and some of the details and the issues that all culminated in the 1934 strike. Let me broaden this out a little bit, and maybe we can and you guys can grab whichever one you want. But, you know, in the future, you know, San Francisco is known as a union town. New York is known as a union town. But we all know that, you know, unions throughout the United States do not have as much density as they did, 30 years ago or so. And but we always, in San Francisco, we always commemorate the 1934 strike. And actually, throughout the United States, this is a symbol of trade union movement throughout the United States. What do you think the impact of this strike has as we look at the future? And what lessons or what pieces of this particular historic strike would be significant in terms of moving forward? I have a lot of questions here to say what is it going to take to grow unions again? Why is, you know, the public sector unions seem to be growing and having some of the fight that the ILWU did in the public sector now? Do you guys want to put that into perspective, you know, over the past 80 years from 1934 to now 2014? Who wants to jump in?
What? How come we didn't get any small questions?
Well, I got a couple of those, too. We'll get to them.
Why don't you start?
Who wants to start?
I can start.
Go ahead.
I think we're, if you were to ask the average person, living in the suburbs, what they think about unions, you're going to get, on the whole, you're going to probably get from moderate to negative responses. There's a thinking in this country that unions have, for the most part, outlived their use. We're moving towards IT world, next generation, robotics. You know, everyone has a cell phone, everyone's got text messaging. And the question is, where do unions fit in? And I think unions, and ours included, have to look at reinventing themselves to the extent that they can adapt to an ever-changing labor environment. It used to be that you just had to deal with politics and work and not much else. But now it's trying to look 5-10 years down the road and trying to anticipate what's going to happen next. It's almost like our education system, trying to educate our kids for technologies that no one's even thought of yet. How do you do that? You know, it's a tough question. But I think we have to stay vigilant in paying attention to what's happening now, anticipating what's going to happen, and preparing ourselves as best we can to fit into whatever that world's going to be 5, 10, 20 years from now.
Do any of the other of you want to jump in this? And it doesn't have to be specifically about a trade union, but just the whole context within the economy?
Historians are always very cautious about predicting the future. But it does strike me that one of the trends that's not likely to reverse and likely to continue is that more and more manufacturing moves out of the United States or moves from states with unions to right-to-work states, and that as a consequence, the kind of bedrock of blue-collar unionism that existed in the 1930s and 40s and 1950s is never going to come back because we've lost so much manufacturing to other parts of the world or to those states where it's almost impossible to organize unions. And so unionization has to move to other areas if it's going to survive. It has, and that's, I think, one of the explanations why public employee unionism has been a growth area, because as long as we have public employees, they have working conditions that need to be addressed. And the real challenge facing the union movement is to identify other groups of workers who have those sorts of needs and reach out to them and help them to organize themselves.
So another question from the audience. Did you want to?
No, I think that's entirely right. I mean, you get into the tech industry, and the two principles of them are no unions and no pensions. And it seems that everybody is 27 years old. And as you know, when you're 27 years old, you're immortal. You don't need a pension. And everything is going to be great. But it's a challenge to make those people understand and make those people realize that there's something more than being 28 years old, that down the road we're going to have to do something. And I think a union would be the answer, but I'm kind of pessimistic about that. I've been on strike twice, and we just had the 20th anniversary of our 1994 strike. And, you know, I'm reminded of a celebration, a museum I went to in Austria, and they had a museum about the Austro-Hungarian army, and I thought it was a famous victory, but I'm not sure we'd do it again. So it's really scary.
Okay, so very specific question, again, from the audience. And I know John had talked about the march inland, I think it was how you referenced it. Just wondering if there's the audience members asking if the ILWU is organizing any warehouses.
I can say that the ILWU has an organizing department. The organizing department works across all the different sectors of the ILWU, whether it's longshore, warehouse, inland boatmen's union, Canadian, Hawaii, and they're very active in organizing in all these different areas. The problem is all the laws are stacked against us. We have some of our labor attorneys here from Leonard Carter's office who do a wonderful job for us, and they could tell you better than I could, just about every law in the country when it comes to labor is stacked against labor. And it's a tremendous job today. Ever since the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in 1948, it's been a slow downhill slide ever since then. And if someone were to ask me what it needs to, what, Tim, you mentioned earlier about the NLRB, things seemed fine when the Wagner Act was passed. Maybe that's what we should look at going back to and making it easier to organize, not just the ILWU, but all sectors, all unorganized workers. Everyone should have a voice. Everyone should have collective bargaining rights. Shouldn't be worried about losing your job just because you want to speak up for what you think is right. That's a fundamental principle that I believe every worker in the United States should have.
Thanks, John. Anybody else want to jump on that one?
Well, on warehouse, you know, the ILWU, as I noted, did have a big organizing drive called the March Inland in period 1934 to 1938 or so, organizing close to 9,000 workers in San Francisco area. But over time, The union ran into some problems. They did expand organizing during World War II, the early 1940s, 1941 to 40, 1945. They expanded into the South, into the West, into the Midwest. They even had a warehouse, and big one in Chicago with 500 workers. They had one in Washington, D.C., if you can imagine, all over the place, up and down the Mississippi River. In the McCarthy period, there was a tremendous attack by other organizations, by the government and so on the ILWU. The fellow was Secretary of Treasury at that time, Louis Goldblatt, said in the convention proceedings, you can read it, in 1949, he said, you know, we're being under such attack, the National Labor Relations Board will not make decisions in our favor. They are trying to undermine us. So he had various organizations, including the federal government, trying to undermine the organizing drive, which was nationwide, and it did actually recede backward toward the West Coast. Those groups either lost their warehouse locals, or they were taken over by other organizations. Later on, after the war, you have beginning, particularly around the 1970s, 1980s, of warehouses moving out of the Bay Area to avoid the ILWU, moving to places like Tracy, you know, where the cops would come in and bop you on the head if you tried to organize. So, you know, there was a lot of difficulties that have been run into. In recent years, there have been a couple of organizing successes, one a big one at the Rite Aid warehouse in Southern California. There have also been a few big losses. So the union has tried. It's really been an uphill battle, and that's the warehouse division.
Yeah, a couple pieces. So the San Francisco Labor Council, which represents over 100 unions here in San Francisco and every sector that you could think of, both in the public and the private sector, we were actually housed in the ILWU hall, the Harry Bridges building over on Franklin Street on Cathedral Hill. And the organizing department literally is right next door to where our offices are. And for the person who asked the question, the president of the warehouse union, ILWU Local 6, actually sits on the executive committee of the San Francisco Labor Council. So I do know that they are organizing, but it's, again, in this economic climate, organizing is very difficult with broken labor laws. So here's another question from the audience. What advice do you give young workers today in regards to fighting for their rights with their employers in other industries? Is there any hope if there's no union available for these workers to seek assistance from? So somebody want to grab that piece?
You know, at times I've told people who've said, you know, oh, it's, you know, we've lost everything, it's on the ground, we've been completely beaten down. I've said, you know, there's certain things you can do. You can take labor studies classes at San Francisco State and City College. You can, you know, find avenues if you look hard for them. It's not easy, and it's always an uphill battle. But I've always tried to tell young people who've raised these questions, you know, look around. There are things out there. Perhaps this is a kind of a feeble effort to you know, get a positive answer out, but at least that's, you know, there are things you can do. You know, I used to teach classes at City College, for example, and State, and, you know, the big labor studies program at City College right now still exists. Yeah.
So people, it was mentioned that, you know, with the mechanization and the containerization of the waterfront, that a lot of the jobs that were traditionally in San Francisco are now over in Oakland. President McKay had referenced the opening of a new cruise terminal here in San Francisco. And John, do you maybe want to give a little overview as to what this new great activity is here in town?
Sure. A couple months ago, many of you may know that Pier 27, the James R. Herman cruise ship terminal, opened for the first time. The terminal was named after the second international president in the history of our union, Jimmy Herman. And Jimmy was a ship's clerk here in San Francisco from Local 34. He was actually the president when I started on the waterfront, and he was much more than just a longshoreman's president. He was very instrumental in working with Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers and assisting them with their strikes in the 60s and 70s. Jimmy helped to found the Delancey Street Foundation. For those of you that know about this foundation, this is an organization that dedicates itself to assisting people who had been incarcerated, getting back into society, offering them residence and teaching them trades that they could learn and carry on for employment purposes. We were successful in lobbying the city government, the Port Commission, to name this cruise ship terminal after a great, not only labor leader, but I think a great humanitarian. And there'll be an interactive video that'll be running that hundreds of thousands of people that will now come to San Francisco, they'll be able to see videos of who Jimmy Herman was, what he did, and what he stood for. So I think it's a very important thing. It's something that the city should be very proud of.
Great. Thank you, John. So now I'm going to do a real non sequitur, and I'm going to put Professor Cherney on the spot. So how did the labor movement let Reagan get away with firing the air traffic controllers?
That's a good question.
Who did that? Who wrote that one?
That's a good
okay.
question.
You want to take a stab at that?
Well, I remember that. I seem to remember, in fact, that the air traffic controllers had endorsed Reagan for president, if I remember correctly. I remember lots of union members didn't fly in airplanes for a while. I remember driving to Los Angeles for meetings. Mm-hmm. Didn't seem to work. There's a larger question here, and that is, can a union really fight the federal government? I think that's the real question. It's not how did Reagan get away with it. It's can a union really fight the federal government if all the forces of the federal government are brought to bear against it? Well, I think they have a bigger army, and that the real response is that for the labor movement to fight those sorts of things, they have to organize politically. And they have to organize and fight those politicians who are anti-labor. I hope somebody has a better answer than that.
Well, it could be added briefly that the labor movement really was slow to respond to that crisis at that time. There was a certain lack of militancy, and I don't think the labor movement officers, head of the FLCIO in Washington, D.C., really realized how much of a threat there was, and it was going to be an opening wedge for a big anti-union drive, which would continue, you know, until last morning's news. You know, I think there was a little lack of response. There's been some literature on this by scholars. You know, they didn't quite see how important this moment was. It turned out to be very important.
So I'm going to ask another, global question, and this is coming from the audience, and we touched on it at least slightly in some of the questions that we have. And I'm asking the panelists to be creative as I ask this pretty simple question. What would it take now to grow unions in the United States? I mean, that is really a softball game.
Well, we could start with getting involved. You know, there's maybe it's my generation's fault, and maybe it's a younger generation, but you see fewer and fewer people want to be involved in collective issues. Fewer people want to vote. I mean, that's a democratic process, whether we like it or not. There's just fewer and fewer people want to vote. There's a me generation. You know, what's in it for me? I don't care about the guy to my left or my right. What about me? And as long as people are not willing to get involved like we used to, and this pervasive attitude of me first and everyone else second continues, it's going to be a natural decline. Until that changes, I don't think anything else can move forward until we can change that way of thinking and get people involved like we used to have.
I'd like to hear Tim's views on that question.
Well, how much time do we have? No, I think that I'm going to tell you right now that the trade union movement in Washington and in the international headquarters throughout the United States is really dealing with this as though we're in a crisis state. And I can say for one thing that here in San Francisco, we are kind of an incubator for some of the models that we're going to be looking at, because it's pretty clear with the National Labor Relations Act that the collective bargaining model is really one of the most difficult things to get through. Because of the state of the way the National Labor Relations Act is structured, one out of four union activists that want to join a union are terminated without any just cause. I mean, there, you know, it'll go through the courts for 2 years, and when it's all said and done, the boss will have to put a little sign on his or her office to say they won't do it anymore. In the meantime, the worker has to find another job. And we're really, you know, going to have to start rethinking exactly what's going on. I talked to Harold Meyerson, a reporter with the American Prospect, the other day, and I told him, we're going to have to start doing collective bargaining in non-traditional ways. We're going to have to do collective bargaining through legislation. We're going to have to do collective bargaining through ballot measures. We obviously have to get a little bit more involved in the political arena, because let's be clear, cynical though we may be, those laws that you know, either repress us or help us are actually passed, and we are a nation of laws, and the laws really don't work for working men and women right now. So we are going to have to start working like we do in San Francisco with other community groups. I work with as many community groups in different issues in San Francisco through the labor councils as I do with the over 100 affiliate unions. We can't do it alone, and we're going to have to, you know, basically find an environment that the cities and states and the country that we're in will be governed so that it is a good place for people to go to school and can afford health care and actually put food on the table. And we are being denied that when we try to organize to get a collective bargaining agreement and a contract with the employer. It just isn't working. The system is broken. So we really that's my answer, Professor. That we're gonna have to be much more creative, and we are thinking of all different models. The labor councils and many of the international unions that are put together were put together in models that were created before, and as Carl was saying, before there were automobiles and TVs and stuff. There were over 500 labor councils in the United States, and it was, you know, done in a time when regions were travel and other things were a lot harder. So there's all kinds of committees and working groups that I actually happen to be involved with, and I know the leadership of the ILWU is involved with really trying to figure out what models are going to work so that, you know, working men and women are going to have economic and economic justice and freedom. And there's some exciting things going on. You know, Walmart's, you know, there was, you know, over 200 stores throughout the country where, you know, people that, you know, can least afford, it's a crappy job, but it's their job, they actually went on the street and they were protesting, you know, because they say, you know, a third of the people working for Walmart qualify for public assistance. I mean, there's just something wrong with this model. And so we're going to have to start thinking of many different things to move forward. So I see that we are running out of time right now, and I'm going to, we have time for just one. Unfortunately, we're at the time where we have time for just one more question. And I don't think I'm going to ask a question, but I would like to have each of the panelists just very quickly, less than 30 seconds, just say, just a quick sum up of the discussion, the short discussion we've had commemorating the 1934 strike, starting with Harvey. Just a quick sum up, please.
Well, the ILWU's got this long, wonderful legacy. We've learned a lot about it tonight. I hope it can be carried on, and I think this is certainly helpful that it might be. I can't help but comment on the last topic. You know, one of the problems with unionism was at times of recession, sometimes the membership would go down in the 19th century. Come along 1929, the Great Depression, everybody, 25 to 35% of the workforce is out of work. It's desperation time. All of a sudden, people were not fearful of holding back because there seemed like there's nothing to lose. Ford Motor Company cuts wages drastically, for example, in the 1933-35 period, after trying not to during the Depression. There's a kind of, it's like a crisis time, and that's when, even though the labor law was still not particularly strong in terms of being pro-labor like it was in 1935, Bob mentioned the 33 Act that the employers brushed aside. You know, it was a crisis time, and it was like desperation. And maybe that's when, you know, there is thunder on the part of labor when a situation like that arises. And people, you know, even though the law was not particularly helpful, they still went out in these huge strike waves in 1934. How, you know, you steal that thunder and put it in a bottle. These are historic issues.
Good point, Dr. Schwartz. We got to keep moving. Dr. Cherney, quick. I think we're down to
very quickly.
Seconds now.
If there's one thing that I think the history of the ILWU should teach all workers, it's the importance of standing together, the importance of solidarity. They did 3-month-long strike in 34, a 3-month-long strike in 36, a 3-month-long strike in 48, and they came out ahead in all those cases because they stood together.
Thank you. Brother Costanza.
I think if we look at 1934, and we were talking about all the gains that came out of that strike, let's not forget this was during the Depression. And if a group of people get together and put their minds and backs to achieving such a wonderful set of just legacy that's passed down to us during a Depression, I think I could be hopeful. Maybe I'm optimistic, but I think if we work hard enough, we can turn things around and move forward and actually improve the lives. And I'm talking union and non-unionized work folks, everyone, just labor in general. It's nothing is impossible. If it could be done before, under even worse circumstances, it could be done again today.
Thank you. Carl Nolte.
I think what the unions would want to do if they wanted to succeed as they did in the 30s and later is to have people like John express their point of view. Unfortunately, when they have strikes, you don't see that very often. The union has not been able to get their point across. They should study people like this who is able to present the union point of view articulately and simply.
Hold on, here you go. Thank you.
Oh. For those of you in the radio audience, money was changing hands. So on that last note, I want to thank, we've run out of time, and I want to thank our panelists, Dr. Harvey Schwartz, who's a historian for the ILWU, Dr. Robert Cherney, who's the history professor emeritus at San Francisco State University, John Costanzo, member of the ILWU Local 10 and the Coast Benefits Specialists, and Carl Nolte, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. And we want to thank our audiences here and also on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Tim Paulson, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.